This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Lucy Hockings from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at shifting political winds in Silicon Valley. This week, Donald Trump's chat with Elon Musk cemented their friendship after years of animosity. But he's not the only tech entrepreneur shifting his support behind the Republicans. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, welcome to this Moneybox podcast. Millions of people will pay tax on their savings interest this year as rates remain high, but tax thresholds are frozen. How do you pay it? Court-appointed deputies say banks won't let them act properly for the person they protect. And prepare your baby for retirement with a 25% boost from the government. But first, the top police officer in charge of combating robbery in England and Wales has told Moneybox he's rolling out new tactics to all forces to tackle a big rise in theft using mobile phones. It begins with a robbery, stealing your unlocked phone, and ends with the thieves using your banking apps to steal hundreds, thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of pounds. I talked to Commander Richard Smith earlier this week, but before hearing from him, here's a reminder that Moneybox first reported on this problem 2.5 years ago. Since then, we've spoken to many victims, people like Ed, Jacopo, and first here, Ben, whose drink was spiked on a night out before criminals took his phone and used it to steal £18,000.
Well, I felt terrible, absolutely terrible. And then over the next few days, I just couldn't stop thinking about it and couldn't sleep. Found it very hard to eat for the next following days, because ultimately I felt like a bit worried and vulnerable about what happened. I can't remember anything that happened, but clearly someone targeted me, and they used me when I was in an incapacitated state, which was obviously thinking about it over and over is very, very worrying and quite scary, to be honest.
So I was in London for August bank holiday. It's actually my friend's birthday. So we'd been out. I was approached and my phone was forcibly stolen out of my hands. From that point, I scrambled to basically look to close my accounts down and freeze my iPhone. I was in a real state of shock and panic.
I was sort of stopped in my tracks a little bit. I froze and tried to sort of regain my thoughts and thought, okay, what's the best approach here? I contacted my bank. I was completely frightened, alarming to see all your hard-earned money sort of taken away from you. I was in complete shock how it could have happened.
The latest figures show that last year there were 20,000 victims of this crime who lost between them £45 million, and those figures are up by around a third for the money and two-thirds on the number of victims in just 1 year. So, in this exclusive interview, I asked Commander Smith first how the police were responding to this new crime wave.
First of all, the impact on victims is appalling. The impact of having a theft is awful anyway, but then the extra impact it has of having a fraud committed afterwards and the financial detriment that brings is dreadful. So the team started looking really carefully at what opportunities the offending pattern would give us to identify who's doing this and how to bring them to justice. And actually, what we found is the offenders are leaving a digital trail that can be followed. That's how these first offenders were identified and brought to justice. And as you can imagine, what we're starting to find is it's not one single offence. They will have committed a number that we can then track back through. And as I said, those first cases are going through the courts now. But what we're also doing is looking at that methodology, looking at what we're learning, and then rolling that out to other investigators, firstly wider through London, and then also nationally to other major metropolitan forces and other forces through England and Wales. So investigators can follow those same clues.
So the first arrests, some people in court, but nevertheless, the crime was up by a third in terms of money and two-thirds in terms of victims. So you can really only arrest a very few people, can't you?
Well, you're absolutely right. So arrests and prosecutions are one element of this. But from my perspective as a police officer, I don't want to see these offences taking place at all. So our focus is very much on understanding how we can prevent these offences taking place at all. And there are a number of levels to that. And we've been doing a lot of work with the industry, with telecommunications providers and with handset manufacturers to try and get there using their technical expertise. And then also working with the financial industry, advising them of what we're seeing so they can look to all their own processes and understand how they can mitigate the impact on victims. And then I guess the last and the broadest element of it is educating people so that they are less likely to become a victim of this kind of offence. So we know when they take place, we know where they tend to take place, we even know the kind of demographic that tends to be targeted. So getting some very deliberate crime prevention advice out to those people.
Yes, I mean, those messages are obviously important, but people might see that as sort of blaming the victims. I mean, they're not doing anything wrong, are they? They're making a call, they're using a map to find their way. They're not doing anything wrong. And yet, the only way to stop this, it seems, is to keep your phone in your pocket.
So absolutely not blaming victims. People should have phones with them. We all live on our phones now, and that's absolutely right. But for all of us, there are steps we can take to make sure that we're less likely to be targeted. We know, for example, this type of offending is often targeted at young men in their 20s and 30s in and around nighttime economy hotspots, so near licensed premises, where they might be engaged in conversation. So we say to people, you know, make sure that you're never going to hand over your phone when it's in an unlocked state. There are other things that people can do. We can all make sure that our handset passcode isn't easy and simple to watch or, you know, identify over a shoulder through shoulder surfing, make it more complicated, having separate passwords for other apps. These are all things we can do. And the handset manufacturers as well, there is stolen device protection on some of these handsets. So making sure that we are all accessing that. There are all of these steps that many of us can take to make us less likely to be victimised.
I mean, there is a thought, isn't there, that because banks usually, though we find many cases where they don't, but they usually refund this money that's stolen in this way, does that make the police not take it as seriously? Because you think, well, he's lost his phone, that can be replaced. She's lost her money, she'll get that back from the bank. It's not really a police matter.
This is certainly being taken seriously. I mean, I'm the national lead for robbery, and this was brought to my door because the Metropolitan Police felt that it was such an important emerging issue they were seeing that it deserved a national response. The Met were very, very concerned to see the escalation in this type of offending and the financial impact on individual victims. So I can see that that one force were definitely taking it seriously and felt it needed a national response.
You say that you've had some great success in the Metropolitan Police in London with this crime, and that you're now rolling that out nationally. Tell me more about that. How are you doing that, and where is that going?
This particular type of offending was identified first by the Met. A dedicated team was established to start understanding the when and where and some of the techniques we could use to prevent and then investigate these offences. And then through the national network that I have, reaching out to all of the forces in England and Wales, we're taking the skills that they've learned and then we're rolling those out to other forces, firstly into the big metropolitan centres where we see more of this type of offending, and then wider, so that they understand when and where this offending is likely to be happening in their patch. And then their detectives have those skills to follow the digital footprint wherever it may lead, identify those responsible and bring them to justice.
And does this make it more important than ever that people report the crime to the police?
Absolutely. Always report it to the police and report it as soon as you possibly can.
Commander Richard Smith from London's Metropolitan Police with good advice there about protecting yourself from this horrible crime. Most people can have just £1,000 a year in savings interest before they start paying income tax on it. That allowance has been frozen since 2016, but in that time the best interest rates on savings have risen from around 1.25% to 5%. So more and more of us are paying tax on our savings interest. Analysis by the bank Shawbrook suggested over 6 million savings accounts are now set to earn enough interest to take them over that savings tax threshold, and that's more than double the number the year before. Official figures from HM Revenue and Customs project a big rise in the tax collected on savings interest, amounting to an extra 9 billion extra tax this year compared with 3 years ago. In November, HMRC told us that for the majority of customers, this tax on savings interest is automatically collected using their tax code. But many listeners get in touch concerned that they will have to pay tax and wondering how to do it. Hilary sent us this email.
Hi, Moneybox. My query is over having to fill out a tax return when I've been on low income and on PAYE for decades, but having inherited money from my parents. My guess is yes, I will, as interest will be over the 5,000 limit on savings income for 2023-2024. I'm gathering documents, but could you please tell me where I can find a copy of the tax return? I've been told that I could wait for HMRC to contact me in October, and then if they don't, I need to contact them. But I do find this worrying.
And Raymond, a retired lecturer from South Wales, is also worried.
I'm allowed £1,000 tax-free on savings interest, but over £1,000 savings, then I have to report it. My question would be, why do we have to double source this information when the banks should send the interest earned directly to you, which they do anyway? And what I would like, ideally, is at the end of the financial year to have a summary of where I am being taxed, but the HMRC never do that. They just say, we're taxing you such and such amount on your savings, but it doesn't say where it's come from.
Our two worried listeners. Now, we heard from HMRC on Friday that following what it called customer and stakeholder feedback, it was looking to further improve its guidance on how to pay tax on income from savings. With us is Helen Thornley from the Association of Taxation Technicians. And Helen Thornley, before we get on to that news from HMRC, I'm sure some listeners are scratching their heads because Raymond mentions the £1,000 savings limit. Hilary says it's £5,000, which is right.
Well, they're both right. There's two aspects. There's the personal savings allowance, which is the amount you can have tax-free up to £1,000 if you're a basic rate taxpayer who earns less than £50,000. And then the £5,000 is part of the starting rates for savings. And that allows low earners between £12,500 and £17,500 to have up to a further £5,000 of interest tax-free.
Yes, thanks for explaining it, but it's not as simple as people might expect, is it? Let's go back to Raymond. He's been contacting HMRC, telling them how much tax he expects to pay on his savings. Does he need to do that?
No, if it's only tax on savings, then he needs to leave HMRC a little bit of time for them to get in touch with him. They get the information direct from the banks, and then they should, unless he has savings incomes of more than £10,000 a year, HMRC won't be expecting a tax return from him.
Right, well, that's good news too for Hilary, because she's desperately been looking for a tax return to print off and look at it. That's not necessary from what you say.
No, it doesn't sound like it. I would allow HMRC generally until the end of October to get in touch, and then if you haven't heard from them, get in touch yourself to say you think you should be taxed.
Right. But how widespread are these misunderstandings?
Very common. We get a lot of queries from people who are concerned, and I think it's because HMRC's guidance doesn't make it clear where the responsibilities lie over when to get in touch.
Well, of course, as I said, on Friday, I mean, we've covered this a few times. You've spoken to us about it before. And HMRC told us on Friday it's looking to improve that guidance. And it mentioned customer and stakeholder feedback, which may mean your organisation and Moneybox, Helen. What should it do to improve the guidance and dispel these misunderstandings?
Yeah, I think it's really clear that HMRC clarifies responsibilities. So they're currently saying they will sort the tax out. But we hear of instances where this matching process, where they match the information from the banks to taxpayers, doesn't always work. And we need clarity on what people should do and when they should take action. They need to allow time for HMRC to get through this processing, but HMRC needs to give us a deadline by which, if you've not heard, you should get in touch.
Yes, because, I mean, with 6 million accounts liable, potentially liable for tax, even if they get 99.99% right, they're going to get some wrong, aren't they? And those people should contact them if they haven't been contacted by, you say, the end of October.
Yes, I think pragmatically that just gives HMRC enough time to get the simple assessments and the P800s that they'll issue out.
Yes. Now, we're talking about money in ordinary savings accounts where the interest is taxable. Cash held in an ISA is, of course, tax-free. Because of this growing tax on ordinary savings accounts, should people now be seriously moving their money to an ISA if they don't have one?
Yes, if they think they're going to pay tax on their interest, it's worth considering an ISA. It won't fix their historic tax problems, but it might help keep them out of a tax tax on savings interest in the future.
Yes, and of course, people don't have to be rich particularly, do they, to face this problem. £20,000 at 5% would take you over the £1,000 limit. So anyone with an ordinary savings account, you say, should consider an ISA, but you can move up to how much a year?
You can move up to £20,000 a year.
Helen Thornley of the Association of Taxation Technicians. Thanks. Now, a few weeks ago, we told you about the difficulties some people with powers of attorney were having with banks, which often didn't let them open accounts, pay money in, take it out, or move it around on behalf of the person they acted for. And we had a big, big response to that story, and that's included people having similar difficulties with what are called deputyships. Now, they're very similar to a power of attorney, but a deputyship order is made by a judge in court, not by the individual granting that power to a relative. So deputies are authorised by the court to handle the financial affairs of a person without the capacity to do it themselves. They can be solicitors, but they can also be relatives. Jill Ackers became a deputy for her disabled daughter, Ellie, when she turned 18. She opened an account in her daughter's name to manage her finances. All went well until Jill needed to change some direct debits.
They wouldn't allow me to do it over the phone and I couldn't access online banking. And they said I had to go into a branch to make any changes to the account. So I did that a couple of times. But it, you know, it's a faff to have to go into a branch to change direct debit each time. They don't know what you're talking about when you're at the counter and the girl goes off and she checks with somebody and then she makes a phone call and then somebody comes back and they ask for a copy of the call to protection order. And it's just hassle. It's one of those things, and it applies generally when you're the parent of a disabled child, that everything you do is two or three times harder than it should be. And you think, I haven't got the bandwidth emotionally or actually just time to keep having to do things in such a complicated and roundabout way.
And this problem doesn't just affect relatives who are deputies. Solicitor Lauren Eyre is an associate at the legal firm Kingsley Napley.
The bank registered the deputyship order, but they actually then proceeded to put a block on all of his debit cards, to put a freeze on the account, and then to actually cancel all of his standing orders and direct debits. Now, that meant that everything that he had set up to his accounts, all of his payments for his utilities, gas, electric, water, his phone bill, his internet, his care payments, they were all just stopped and cancelled. Also, he just had no access to any funds. He couldn't use his bank card. Luckily, we had some really understanding family members who stepped in and could help by giving him cash payments and just help us along the way. I've been working in this field for almost 8 years now, and it doesn't seem to have changed or got better. It actually seems to have got worse in that time.
Well, listening to that is Gemma Hopper. She's a solicitor and also director of the Association of Lifetime Lawyers. Gemma Hopper, we heard from Jill and Lauren there. Lauren said the problems are getting worse. Are they common?
Yes, unfortunately, they're very common. I experience them myself in the court protection team that I work with, and we hear it quite a lot from our members at the association. So it's not just, you know, members of the public who are representing their family members, it's also professionals that are struggling with banks at the moment.
Yes, and we heard families having to step in there with cash. I mean, what is the impact of these problems?
It's impacting our most vulnerable clients' day-to-day lives, really, in terms of accessing funds, paying their bills, clearing care debt at times as well. And it's very distressing for people who already have complex care needs. So we're really urging banks to listen and to communicate with us.
But it's more than distressing, I suspect, in some cases, though, because if the bank is obstructing you, if you like, in your lawful duties to do the best with the money for that person who can't manage for themselves, they're actually stopping you doing their job, and there must be expenses they have that absolutely have to be met.
Absolutely, yeah. And inevitably what the banks aren't also appreciating is when there's a professional involved, we have our own management costs, and the additional administration surrounding this can be very frustrating. We're monitoring that quite a bit within the team here that I work for at Nelson's, and we're really conscious of that. So we are working, you know, with the associations and vulnerable banking groups to try and get this addressed, because we want it to be efficient. you know, banks have to do their checks and due diligence, but it's already gone through the court of protection, so the person that's appointed is the right person to make those decisions and needs quick access.
Yes, I mean, banks might say that, you know, we have to be careful about fraud, about financial abuse, we have to protect our customers. Do you think that's why some seem to put barriers in the way of deputies and attorneys? They want to do the job you're supposed to do, which is to protect your client.
Absolutely. In the initial registration process, there should be checks there. We're not saying there shouldn't. They should be able to look at the court order and realise who's involved and do that identification check. That's not a problem. But it's also the ongoing management of the bank account which causes more frustration, I feel, in terms of practical use of the court order.
Yes, I mean, we heard about direct debits being a particular source because obviously people do want to change those, don't they, or change
yes.
standing orders. It's just part of the normal day-to-day managing of a bank account. We asked six of the biggest banks to come on the programme. Sadly, all of them refused, and UK Finance, which represents the banks, referred us to a previous statement. Now, in that, it did admit that there's more to be done, and it said banks are working on it. Lauren says it's getting worse. You say it's certainly not getting any better. What needs to happen next?
I do feel personally that a lot of banks need to address this internally in terms of training. There is a clear training need. You know, we can approach a bank and get a different response, even though we're asking for the same thing, which is extremely frustrating. And for banks to really acknowledge that they've got vulnerable clients that need this support, and also that their staff, you know, the people that work with the banks, they need the adequate training to understand what they're being presented with.
Yeah, so is it down to that? It's not the policy at the top, it's the practical exposition of that at the bottom in the branch that's the problem.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think there's a lot of policies out there and documents that, you know, the registration forms, they're all available on the banks and the websites and even in branch, but it's the people who are checking, you know, that additional due diligence in-house is just they're not trained to be able to understand what they're seeing day to day.
So briefly, if banks are listening, I hope they are, what's your message to them briefly?
Just reach out to the Association of Lifetime Lawyers. We're here to work with you and to provide support. That would be my main message.
Gemma Hopper, thanks very much.
Thank
indeed.
You.
And there's more on Powers of Attorney on Moneybots Live on Wednesday with Felicity Hannah. She'll have experts on hand to explain how they work or how they're supposed to work. And should you make one, email your questions or experiences, moneybox@bbc.co.uk. And, of course, listen to Moneybots Live at 3 o'clock on Wednesday here on Radio 4. Now, we're often told to save for a pension early, and it seems it's never too early. A pension can be started by parents for a child as young as, well, naught. Moneybox reporter Catherine Lund has the details. Catherine.
Well, a children's pension, or a junior self-invested personal pension, or SIP as they're also known, is a tax-free way of saving for a child's future. A junior SIP, though, can only be opened by a child's parents, but after that, anyone can pay into the account, such as grandparents.
And what are the benefits of doing this?
Well, just like an adult pension, eligible contributions receive a 25% boost from the government. The junior SIP allowance is currently £3,600, but a parent and others actually paying up to a maximum of £2,880 for the year. And then the government chips in with £720 of tax relief, even though the child is unlikely to be a taxpayer. And there will, of course, remember, though, be annual charges from the provider.
Now, I guess parents run this pension, this SIP, at first. What happens at 18?
Well, yes, when the child turns 18, that's when they have to hand over the reins to that child. So you have to trust or hope that the child will handle the money responsibly.
Yeah. But what if they do want to use it? Because there's the responsible way of using it might be as a deposit for a home, for example.
Well, if they take out the money early, this is known as an unauthorised payment, and they will be subject to a tax penalty charge of up to 55%, so not a good idea. They will be at least 57 years old before they can use it without that penalty.
Thanks, Catherine. I suppose that's the age when we finally become responsible, 57. Well, fraud, savings, pensions and looking after someone else's money. The team has covered the lot in this podcast, and forgive me for, well, boasting a little, but Moneybox has just won the Headline Money Award as Best Consumer Money Title in a field of well-known newspapers and websites. Well done, team. And even more of a reason, of course, to tell your friends to subscribe to Moneybox on BBC Sounds so they never miss a prize-winning episode. This podcast's prize-winning team were reporters Dan Whitworth and Catherine Lund, researcher Joe Krasner, studio manager Nathaniel Danter. Our editor is Jess Quayle. I'm Paul Lewis, and this was the BBC News Money and Work production for BBC Sounds. And now, real crime, amateur sleuths.
Home Sleuth is a brand new podcast. Tales from citizens taking justice into their own hands.
Trying to solve crimes.
Catching bad guys.
Living the double life.
Not the police.
I really wanted to find that person. Can you just tell me where she's buried?
Not a victim.
What is ethical? What is the boundary that I should stay within?
An ordinary person compelled to investigate a crime or a mystery.
There was no one else who seemed to care about what was happening.
We'll meet the first internet sleuth.
What do you want to do? Change the world? And I thought, yeah.
A teenage PI.
I noticed details that other people maybe don't see.
And a true crime YouTuber going toe-to-toe with the justice system.
It's fun, but that's not the point. The point is to make a difference.
Home Sleuth from BBC Radio 4 Extra.
I think I found him. Like, this is crazy.
I'm Lucy Hockings from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at shifting political winds in Silicon Valley. This week, Donald Trump's chat with Elon Musk cemented their friendship after years of animosity. But he's not the only tech entrepreneur shifting his support behind the Republicans. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.